from deep inside your radio.
Just checking to see everything was working. Everything's working. All right, that's good. That's good news. Ladies and gentlemen from New Orleans, Louisiana, where everything's working, except the Celtics, I have a... I don't know if this will retire the crown forever, but it sure is the one to beat as a Los Angeles dog trainer correction. Quote, an article in Tuesday's Section A about an address on race by Senator Barack Obama said his rival, Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton, was a Republican from New York. She is a Democrat. Los Angeles dog trainer corrections for you. That's the new theme, by the way, is just the sound of the page. So, good work, boys. Guess Sam Zell hasn't downsized enough, because you're still doing that. Ladies and gentlemen, this credit crunch that's now a money crunch, that's now an economic crunch, as they all do, is having multiple ripples. One you might not have. Certainly I didn't imagine it until I didn't have to because it appeared in the New Orleans newspaper. Across the nation, affordable housing deals, that is to say, arrangements to rebuild affordable housing, such as the 50,000 units destroyed in New Orleans by the federal levee failure and the consequent flooding, those deals are crumbling, don't you know, as investors hurt by the economic downturn lose interest in purchasing the tax credits being used to finance those projects, and lenders pull out. Nowhere is the situation worse than in Louisiana, where Congress created an extra $168 million in tax credits, nearly 20 times the state's regular allocation, after the thing and Hurricane Rita as well, to spur the development of 27,000 affordable housing units. All of the go zone tax credits must be ready for the projects must be ready for occupancy by the end of 2010, so developers can't wait until the market improves for tax credits. It's almost as if the twin disasters, Katrina and Rita, have been caused by the market disaster, says the president of the Louisiana Housing Finance Agency, which awards tax credits to developers. We're really swimming uphill, he says. Developers finance the lion's share of a project's cost by selling their tax credits to investors who use the credits to reduce their tax bills. But with so many large corporations losing money because of the mortgage crisis and the decline in consumer spending, they don't need to buy as many tax credits. With fewer buyers, developers are forced to accept lower prices for their credits so they can't raise as much money to finance their projects. Last year, tax credits were selling for 95 cents to a dollar and now selling in the 80 to 85 cent range. So developers have to find more money. Ralph Coppersmith of Baton Rouge, who is one of the three biggest tax credit syndicators, says that in competing nationally for tax credit investors and lenders, the post-storm, meaning post-flood, blight in New Orleans will make it harder for the city's projects to come together. He's driven bankers around New Orleans and watched them get squeamish as they bump along the city's roads, looking at beautiful homes surrounded by scores of abandoned ones. A lot of syndicators have said, we're maxed out on Louisiana. We want to see what's happening. Thanks for the help, everybody. And it's not just Louisiana, at least as far as formaldehyde fumes are concerned. The Israeli Air Force has ordered all F-16I fighter jets grounded after formaldehyde fumes were found in the cockpit. Commander ordered an examination of strong smells in the cockpit following several complaints. The medical corps found the material in question was formaldehyde. The substance was found in only one of the plane's cockpits, but the Israeli Air Force notified the plane's manufacturer, Lockheed, and an examination is being carried out. Hopefully FEMA is not involved. Ladies and gentlemen, you know, the subject of race in this country is one that when it's brought up, it's like when it enters a realm of discourse, it's like a hip-hop song being played at a basketball arena. When it starts, you can't hear anything else. So I challenge you to find any punditry in the media this week about Barack Obama's Iraq speech. Yeah, he did give one. But as far as the speech on race, of course, it's still tearing up the airwaves. And now he has benefited, I think it's fair to say, from his position of being both a black person and a white person. He's, of course, half both, half each, however you put it. So he said, delivered a speech on Tuesday that benefited from those twin perspectives. However, he got into trouble when he was criticized for bringing up the case of his white grandmother, who he said in the speech had uttered some pejorative words about black people that had made him cringe. And then challenged about why he brought up his grandmother, he said, well, she was just, you know, thinking like a typical white person. So he got slammed for that. But he can make an effective comeback, you see, from his unique position, because he can just say, well, I was speaking as a typical black person. I understand that so in awe is Hillary Clinton of his position of being able to straddle that very crucial divide and to speak from either side of it, that her staff is frantically doing research on her DNA to see if she can claim before the Pennsylvania primary that she's half male. Hello, welcome to the show.
You're a million ways to be cruel.
From the edge of Lake Pontchartrain in New Orleans, Louisiana, I'm Harry Shearer welcoming you to this edition of the show. And ladies and gentlemen, it is time now for me to read the trades for you. That's what I'm going to do.
Meet Harry the Swinger.
No thanks, Ernie. I'm already on the air. From Advertising Age, vodka brand wants call girl to be latest butt girl. I'll read it for you. Dateline Chicago. The owner of Georgie Vodka says he's in talks to put the derriere of former New York Governor Eliot Spitzer's call girl on the backside of every bus in New York. Just one more reason to love New York City. Star Industry CEO Martin Silver, who owns U.S. rights to the brand, told Ad Age, the Bible of the advertising business. Hey, happy Easter, everybody, speaking of Bibles. His firm is making headway in talks to pay Ashley Dupre, her current name, a low six-figure amount to be this year's Georgie Butt Girl, the annual pinup the brand posts on the backs of city buses and the tops of taxicabs. Yes, it's a classy city. Why do you ask? The girl's butt we have on there now, I'm quoting him. Please understand, ladies and gentlemen, this is a quote from Martin Silver. Quote, the girl's butt we have on there now is pretty good. But if you can get Dupre to do it and make some personal appearances, it's like Paris Hilton or something. We're trying to work out a contract, he added. But wait, it gets better. He says one possibility was to create a brand called Number 9, which was Spitzer's designation by the call girl service. Actually, his designation was client Number 9. I'm interpolating there. But he said nothing had yet been decided. Well, then there are going to be some meetings. Can we have tapes of those, please? Silver said his company sprang quickly because he felt the word of mouth buzz. It's all double entendre when you get to this. Ms. Dupre generates would boost his vodka's profile and sales. He said he expects many other brands to come calling. This girl's gonna get inundated with offers, he said. She's worth a lot of money. Unquote. Ms. Dupre's attorney said only he was not aware of any endorsement or any deals, unquote. Well, that's the way to do it, honey. Keep your lawyer in the dark. The whole world is double entendre when I read the trades for you, isn't it? Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. Ladies and gentlemen, how are things working in the field of nuclear waste, you might want me to ask rhetorically. Okay, then. The waste stored in underground tanks at the Hanford Nuclear Reservation, of course, that's where we built a lot of bombs, so it's particularly dangerous nuclear waste, not like the stuff that's going to be in your backyard. Those wastes are so dangerous that their fumes give people headaches, nosebleeds, sore throats, and make them nauseated. An unfortunate few have been doused with the deadly stuff in accidents. One is now dying of cancer, according to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, called by state regulators the most toxic waste known to this environment. I wonder whether they mean Earth. The 53 million gallons of waste. See, if you just took 1 gallon, if everybody listening to me now just took 1 gallon of this waste, we could clean up that whole thing tomorrow. Anyway, they sit in 177 massive buried tanks near the Columbia River, where the fish swim. See how it all works together? To make a better world? Intended for short-term use, some of the tanks are more than a half century old. Well, that's short-term. terms of nuclear waste. They were built of carbon steel, an alloy that just happens to be prone to corrosion. They're cocooned in concrete that in places has cracked and crumbled. A cracked and crumbled cocoon. The contents historically boiled and exploded, and the tank bottoms buckled. Talk about butt girls. Oh, sorry. More than one-third leaked. The tanks are supposed to be emptied and the waste safely trapped in glass, but those plans keep getting pushed back. At the current rate in funding, tanks at Hanford won't be emptied for decades, maybe even a century. So, now, a question no one dared to ask a few years ago, is it time to build new tanks? It's a proposition that's been avoided for fear it would cost too much and give the Energy Department license to further drag its feet in cleaning up the waste. But most of the existing tanks should have been commissioned years ago. The older ones are 30 to 50 years past their intended lifetimes. Even the newer tanks will likely be years past their sell-by date before they're taken out of use. These things are falling apart in the ground while we speak, says Tom Carpenter, executive director of a watchdog group. You've got to do something. Well, of course he says that. He's part of a watchdog group. Some of the risks are catastrophic. Tanks so rotted they collapse under the weight of pumps and other gear used to remove the waste. So maybe we shouldn't be eating that Columbia River salmon after all. The Inspector General Watch produces this week. The terrorism watch list that our federal government maintains to keep you safer. Why do you hate our freedom? They're doing it to keep you safer. Includes inaccurate and outdated information, increasing the risk that innocent people will be misidentified as terrorists while actual terrorists are overlooked. Aside from that, Mrs. Lincoln, it's a fine list. This according to the Justice Department Inspector General, Glenn Fine. This explains why innocent travelers continue to be misidentified as terrorism suspects, despite efforts by the federal government to improve its database. Federal agents describe the watch list as invaluable. I wonder whether they think that means amazingly valuable or not valuable. High-profile blunders have underscored the flaws, such as when Senator Ted Kennedy was repeatedly blocked from boarding planes because his name was similar to a suspect's. Really? I wonder what suspect that was. Ted Maha. The terrorist screening center seized the watch list, while the National Counterterrorism Center and the FBI recommend or nominate names for it. Hey, nomination process. Those are simple. The federal agencies that had set up procedures to catch errors, according to the Inspector General, didn't always remove outdated records from the watch list. The FBI's 56 field offices often provide inaccurate or incomplete information when nominating names. He suggests the FBI require supervisors to review nominations. Kind of like superdelegates, except supervisors, not regular advisors. An FBI spokesman said gaps that the IG identified in the system should be fixed within 6 months. So, Ted Kennedy, make your flying plans for, I guess, October. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week. I know Ted listens to this show, that's why I was talking to him. We're so sorry. All right, first up, Condoleezza Rice on the news this week that some rogue contractors at the State Department were looking into the passport files of, among other candidates for president, Barack Obama.
I told him that I was sorry, and I told him that I myself would be very disturbed that somebody had looked into my passport file, and therefore I will stay on top of it to get to the bottom of it.
She's going to stay on top of it. She's going to get to the bottom of it. Some have way with words. And, ladies and gentlemen, here's CNN news anchor Lou Dobbs.
You were right last night on some numbers, and I was pitifully, pitifully, horribly, and of course, rarely wrong.
You're never wrong, Lou, and it's always worth checking.
I was wrong as you can get wrong last night, and I apologize to you for my wrongness.
Thank you, Lou.
But God, I hate saying that. I really hate it.
It's always worth checking the numbers twice, though.
Where did we learn that? Somewhere along the way in journalism, didn't we? All right. Thank you very much. And it's a lesson often retaught, at least in my case. Thanks, Kitty.
He was talking to Kitty. He didn't say hello, but he was talking to Kitty.
Sorry.
Officials at a Minnesota hospital said a tragic error led doctors to remove the healthy kidney from a patient with cancer. The Minneapolis Star Tribune reported that weeks before the surgery at Methodist Hospital, the wrong kidney was identified on a medical chart, so even when doctors double-checked their materials during surgery, they were led astray. The error was noticed by a pathologist the day after the surgery. Hospital officials had offered an apology to the patient and his family and were offering their support, although not their kidneys. The patient decided to stay at the hospital. Yep. Parenthetically, just pause for this parenthetical note. When I had shoulder surgery last year at one of the best, maybe the best place in L.A., who knows, just before the anesthesiologist applied his magic stuff, they gave me a magic marker and said, please write on your right shoulder, right arm, which was the one that was being operated on, the word yes. Okay, ladies and gentlemen. The University of Virginia Cavalier Daily has apologized for offending students at the university after it published a pair of controversial religious cartoons last week. Students opened the paper a week ago Thursday and saw a cartoon of Jesus on the cross making jokes as a stand-up comic. The student-run newspaper published another cartoon depicting a sexual encounter with the Virgin Mary. Nevada Governor Jim Gibbons says he will replace three members of the state board charged with investigating physician involvement in Southern Nevada's health care crisis. He also apologized for saying media buffoonery was creating the hysteria over cases of hepatitis tied to the massive health alert, about which I've not ever heard because we're too busy discussing the election. Dateline Lincoln, Nebraska. Attorney General John Bruning has apologized for harsh remarks made 2 weeks ago after the legislature's Judiciary Committee killed an illegal immigration measure backed by him and the governor. Attorney General Bruning apologized for saying the committee was an embarrassment. A British cruise ship captain has apologized to passengers after accusing them of, quote, behaving like Germans, unquote. The comment came during a Caribbean cruise on the P&O liner Oceania after complaints about the way some passengers were using towels, books, and bags to reserve lounge chairs for long periods. The practice has been a source of friction between German and other European holidaymakers in Mediterranean resorts for years. The captain of the ship, Christopher Wells, who has a German wife, reportedly tried to calm the situation by saying passengers could claim a chair if it had remained unused for 20 minutes. He apparently announced over the ship's intercom that we don't want that kind of Germanic behavior here. The captain has since apologized unreservedly for any offense he may have caused. Dateline Beijing. China Mobile has apologized for its management loopholes that allowed the spread of spam text messages to nearly half the country's cell phone users. The country's largest mobile operator has vowed to block short messages originating from the seven condemned online advertising firms. Dateline Los Angeles, Gary Busey has apologized for embracing Jennifer Garner on the red carpet at the Oscars last month during a live E! Pre-show broadcast, actually cablecast. AP. Busey repeatedly interrupted while Ryan Seacrest was interviewing Garner and Laura Linney. At one point, Busey embraced Garner, who looked annoyed. Quote, I meant no disrespect to Miss Jennifer Garner when I met her at the Oscars and apologize if I made her uncomfortable, the actor said in a statement emailed by his publicist. No, by a publicist for his attorney. Hey, yeah, that's double protection. That's a double barrier. By the time he realized Garner and Linney were being interviewed, Busey said he tried to step back, but suddenly Ryan introduced her to me. Calls to Garner's publicist were not immediately returned. I simply greeted both actresses with joy and open arms, which is the way I would greet anyone I'm happy to meet, Busey says. Everyone has experienced a handshake or hug which has turned awkward, and this is no different. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen. A copyrighted feature of this broadcast. How are things going in Iraq? Yeah, that's another rhetorical question being flung at you by the host of this broadcast. Well, General Petraeus is coming back here to brag on the surge. What a wonderful surge. But, British newspaper The Guardian, the success of the surge may be under threat because Sunni militia employed by the U.S. to fight al-Qaeda are warning of a strike. No, not a military strike. a strike because they're not being paid regularly. Leading members of the 80,000-strong SAWA, or Awakening, councils have said they will stop fighting unless payment of their $10 a day wage is resumed. Please give. The fighters are accusing the U.S. military of using them to clear al-Qaeda militants from dangerous areas and then abandoning them. Well, we wouldn't do that. We didn't do that in Afghanistan. A telephone survey reveals that out of 49 SAWA councils, 4, with almost 2,000 men, have already quit, 38 are threatening to go on strike, and 2 already have. Dozens of phone calls to SAWA leaders reveal bitterness and anger. Quote, "We know the Americans are using us to do their dirty work and kill off the resistance for them, and then we get nothing for it," says the head of the council in the neighborhood known as Abu Ghraib. Abu Ghraib. "The Americans got what they wanted. We purged al-Qaeda for them, and now people are saying, why should we have any more deaths for the Americans? They have given us nothing." Unquote. In a southern suburb of Baghdad, the leaders of a SAWA group of 2,400 men said they were considering strike action because none of the 2,000 applicants they'd put forward for jobs with the police and military had been accepted. The Shia-dominated government has found jobs for only a handful of the Sunni fighters. Says the leader of 35 SAWA councils, the largest group in Iraq, quote, "We need to get all the SAWAs in the country together and organize a national strike. When the areas started to cool down and the situation began to get better, the Americans really cooled to us," unquote. What about the... Oh, I'm not going to phrase this in the form of a rhetorical question. I'm getting bored with that. But remember the Coalition of the Willing? It's more like the Coalition of the Intimidated. Based on this report from the Washington Post, in the months leading up to the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, the Bush administration threatened trade reprisals against friendly countries who withheld their support, spied on its allies, and pressed for the recall of U.N. ambassadors that resisted U.S. pressure to endorse the war. This according to an upcoming book by a top Chilean diplomat. This rough-and-tumble diplomatic strategy has generated lasting bitterness and deep mistrust in Washington's relations with allies in Europe, Latin America, and elsewhere, according to Hector Munoz, Chile's ambassador to the United Nations. In the aftermath of the invasion, allies loyal to the United States were rejected, mocked, and even punished for their refusal to back the UN resolution authorizing the attack on Saddam's government, Munoz writes. The tough talk dissipated as the war situation worsened, and President Bush came to reach out to many of the same allies he had spurned. Munoz's account suggests the U.S. strategy backfired in Latin America, damaging the administration's standing in a region that has long been dubious of U.S. military intervention. The book portrays Bush personally prodding the leaders of 6 governments, Angola, Cameroon, Chile, Guinea, Mexico, and Pakistan, to rally support among the Security Council's non-permanent members for the war resolution. The strategy was aimed at demonstrating broad support for U.S. military plans. Now, I remember that, despite the French threat to veto the resolution. Bush made several appeals to the president of Chile and the Mexican president to rein in their diplomats and support U.S. war aims. "We have problems with your ambassador at the U.N., Bush told the president of Mexico. "It's time to bring up the vote, Ricardo. We've had this debate too long," Bush told the Chilean president. Nice people doing nice things. Why did the... Boy, it's a bad habit, isn't it? The Rand Corporation comes out with a report saying the inability of the United States to monitor insurgent trends in Iraq and apply new counterinsurgency tactics led many Iraqi civilians to side with the sectarian groups, propelling the country to the brink of civil war. Civilians were led into a Faustian... funding in Iraq during the 2003 to 2006 period was focused heavily on safeguarding U.S. troops, such as for improved vehicle armor and electronic detection and jamming equipment, while less attention was paid to protecting Iraqis. As a result, civilians were often led into a Faustian bargain in which they sought the help of sectarian extremists they otherwise might have avoided. The failure to protect the Iraqi population contributed significantly to the increase in insurgency and sectarian violence, says one of the co-authors, a senior defense analyst at RAND. who undertook three assignments in Iraq from 2004 to 2007. The conflict in Iraq is not simply a revolt by disgruntled Sunnis against the Iraqi government, but also a many-sided struggle for power following the collapse of the government. We're making it extremely difficult to confront all of the elements. Were insurgency the only challenge, U.S. and Iraqi government forces might at least contain the violence, but the multiple challenges of separatists, insurgents, extremists, militias, and criminals have made this a much more difficult challenge. So, you know, yeah, maybe 100 years.
Get out of the door, fool. Hey, now, door popping. My big sister can't stop gossiping. Hey, now, door popping. Mama gonna get you in the show after the show. My big sister, hey, now, door popping queen. Always got a face pressed up against the front door screen. Nettie, the fellas, and the whole Tremaine. We're back at my sister when she says, hey, now, hey, now, door popping. Now, don't bother, mama gonna get you, it's your ass for sure. Sticking our 2 cents in and running our mouth. Always gotta know what somebody business be about. She is he don't end my move. Peeking up, shutting straight at you. Hey, now, don't bother, my big sister can't stop gossiping. Hey, now. Is your ass for sure. Mama Mackie, now what I'm on my zone, make my shoe cut or a fresh tonton. Hey, now, door popping. My big sister can't stop gossiping. Hey, now, door popping. Mama gonna get you in the your ass for sure. Hey now, door poppin', my big sister can't stop gossiping. Hey now, door poppin', mama's gonna get you in the show ass for sure. Mama's gonna get you in the show ass for sure. Mama's gonna get you in the show ass for sure. Told you.
This is Le Show, and F is for FEMA, ladies and gentlemen. The, you know, if you, let's just imagine that you wanted to get the records that document FEMA's response to Katrina and Rita. FEMA would charge you almost $210,000 for that. At least that's what's happening now. FEMA is charging the Baton Rouge Advocate $209,990 for records documenting the agency's response to Katrina and Rita, a price deemed absurd by at least one lawmaker. The Baton Rouge Advocate must pay that amount before FEMA will turn over copies of more than 2 million pages of documents relating to inspection and maintenance of government-issued trailers and government-issued trailers, pardon me, and mobile homes. FEMA also gave the newspaper just 10 days to pay or said it would consider the request for the documents withdrawn. The first 100 pages are free, says a FEMA lawyer. The duplication cost for 2 million 99,900 pages will be 10 cents per page for photocopying. FEMA charged fees for public records when a request is so large or complex that staffers must be pulled from their regular duties. I would say, if the Baton Rouge Advocate is pulling FEMA staffers from their regular duties, they are performing a great public service. But that's just me. FEMA has determined that the American taxpayer should not bear the burden of the costs to produce the copies, McIntyre wrote in an email. No, sorry, agency spokesman James McIntyre wrote in an email to the Associated Press. I wonder if he was performing his regular duties or taking time out to reply to the AP. According to the Advocate, none of the records it requested were stored on computers. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I'm a late adopter. But I got into the whole computer thing in about 1993. So what, first the FBI, what is the problem with the government and computers? McIntyre says FEMA is searching its databases to determine if any of the files were electronic. although he said some employees didn't know what a database. No, he didn't say that. I'll take that back. All right, then. We now have the John McCain story, except it wasn't a story, we now realize, because it was explained on Sunday morning's edition of Face the Nation by Doyle McManus, the Washington bureau chief of the Los Angeles dog trainer, that John McCain's little adventure this week was not big news, was not being rerun over and over again like the certain other statements by certain that were related to certain other candidates, because the voters' minds were not on the war in Iraq. And John McCain's statements concerned the war to a certain extent. I am in awe of Doyle McManus, the Washington bureau chief of the Los Angeles dog trainer, for knowing what's on everybody's mind and for being so damn attentive to it that he makes his news judgments accordingly. But here's what McCain did. First, he goes on the Hugh Hewitt radio show, and he says this.
As you know, there are Al-Qaeda operatives that are taken back into Iran, given training as leaders, and they're moving back into Iraq.
He says, okay, you heard it. I don't have to repeat it for you. Then the next day in Jordan, on his Mideast trip, which has nothing to do with politics, that's why we're paying for it, he said this. No, he didn't. He said this.
We continue to be concerned about Iranian taking Al-Qaeda into Iran, training them, and sending them back.
I'm sorry.
The Iranians are training extremists, not Al-Qaeda. I'm sorry.
That's an apology. And the voice you heard in the background was Senator Joe Lieberman correcting McCain. Lieberman just happened to be on this trip to Iraq, you see, that we're paying for, even though he's, well, you know, the fact that he's a supporter of McCain's. Oh, by the way, who else is on the trip with him? Senator Lindsey Graham, another major supporter of the McCain campaign that we're paying for, because it has nothing to do with the McCain campaign. Anyway, so at least twice this week, McCain said Iran was training Al-Qaeda, even though Iran is Shiite and Al-Qaeda is Sunni. Not a big story because American people's minds weren't on Iraq. But clearly not a gaffe, unless it's a repeated gaffe kind of thing that he has. No, I'm not going to say that again because I made a reference to a syndrome a couple of weeks ago that a listener chided me and corrected me on. But it's not just matters of Iraq that Senator McCain needed to be corrected by Joe Lieberman on. Senator McCain said Purim is the Jewish version of Halloween during his visit to Israel. As they celebrate their version of Halloween here, referring to Israeli children, they're somewhere close to a 15-second warning. Lieberman said it was his fault, and he corrected Senator McCain. All right, so it's not a big story, but you know, when the senator misspeaks, it's not a big story, so maybe it'll become a strategy.
From CPR, Continental Public Radio, a special report, a foreign policy misspeech by Senator John McCain, with interpolations as needed by Senator Joseph Lieberman. Now, misspeaking from the Legacy Foundation in Owings Mills, Maryland, Senator John McCain.
Thank you, my friends. It is a privilege for you to be here to listen to me address you here today.
It's a privilege to address you today.
Privilege for me to address you today, of course. And, of course, I speak to you at a time when the question of America's security could be more urgent.
Could not be more urgent.
Could not be, of course. How could it be? It couldn't, is the straight answer. Let's look at the international scene and see how it stacks up in terms of this nation's security. Because, my friends, when you get right down to it, if there is a more important issue in this election, I wouldn't like to know what it is.
No, you would like to.
Or, if you like, I would like to know what it is, because, of course, it isn't. Now, let's take the Middle East, my friends, which has been the scene of so much tension and bloodshed during our lifetimes. Now, whatever you think of the Iraq invasion, and of course, I think Saddam Hussein was a tyrant who sponsored terrorism around the corner.
Around the world.
Around the world is where he sponsored it, of course. But whatever you think, the Middle East has become a more dangerous place. Less dangerous place as a result. Today, Iraqis are enjoying more electricity each day than they did under Saddam Hussein.
Less electricity.
Or, if you like, less electricity. There is less unemployment than there...
There's more.
More unemployment than there was under the tyrant. But, of course, that employment was tyrannized, my friends. Utterly tyrannized. And we all know that we did not embark upon this struggle just to improve the economic circumstances of the Iraqi people. We don't know why we embarked.
We do know.
We do know why we embarked on this struggle. It was to ensure lower oil prices.
It wasn't to ensure lower.
I've got it. It was not to ensure lower oil prices, my friends, nor was it to remove weapons of mass destruction which we knew Saddam possessed.
It wasn't to remove WMDs which he didn't possess.
Or if it was, he didn't. But very simply, my friends, we embarked on this struggle to confront the jihadists and the jihadists and the mujahideen. What he said, who pose an existential threat to the United States, a threat against which we cannot prevail.
We can.
Against which, I say again, which we cannot but prevail. That is to say, we can. I supported this war when I opposed the way it was being fought. I support it now that I support the way it's being fought, and should I become your president, and should I once again oppose the way it's being fought, I will still support it. Is that right?
That's what you wrote.
Why would I...
If you become president, it will be fought the way you support.
And if I become your commander-in-chief, it will, of course, be fought the right way, the way that points to an immediate or short-term victory.
To achieve.
The way that leads to the only kind of victory worth having, one that must, may yet cost us years and billions, trillions of dollars. So the question is, my friends, will it be worth it in terms of our nation's security? Well, let's just look around the Middle East for a minute.
A moment.
See, that's not really worth correcting. Iran is weaker than it was when we toppled Saddam Hussein.
They are stronger.
Or rather, they're stronger, which is why our toppling days, shall we say, may not be over. Libya has renounced nuclear weapons, my friends, and rejoined the family of nations. And North Korea, which hasn't, fortunately for us, is not in the Middle East.
That's right.
Good. What we face with our Democrat friends this fall is an election that will decide whether we pursue the successful surge strategy and refuse to let it wind down.
And let it wind down.
And refuse to not let it wind down, I should say. Or, as our Democrat friends would have us do, and wind it up and surrender. So wind down or wind up, to oversimplify, and not to put too fine a point on it. Either we let al-Qaeda trumpet to the world that they have defeated us, or if I am president, we remain steadfast with a strategy that will, if you will, mute al-Qaeda's trumpet. The decision, my friends, is up to the Iraqis.
It's up to us.
But it's really, if you want some straight talk, it's really up to the American people. As we begin the fifth year of...
Sixth year.
Or rather, end the fifth year of this difficult battle. The question is not, my friends, was it worth it? The question is, would not fighting this war have been more worth it? I hope you'll agree with me. The answer to both questions is yes.
First question.
I'm not through with the speech.
The answer to the first question is yes.
The answer to the first question is yes. So we'll start with the second question. Thank you very much, and God bless Armenia.
America.
And even more importantly, America.
You've been listening to Senator John McCain, part of his Miss Speaking Tour on the subject of America's foreign policy future. Funds for this special broadcast came from the Fund for Special Broadcasts. I'm Ira Zipkin. This is CPR, Continental Public Radio.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the warm, won't you?
Soft, listen to the warm. We can listen to the warm.
Oh, yes, we can. The amount of long-lasting sea ice in the Arctic declined sharply in the past year, even though the region had a cold winter and the thinner one-year ice cover grew substantially. This long-lasting ice lasts for much as long as a decade. As a result of melting and the southward movement of the thicker ice, the percentage of the Arctic Ocean with this stable ice cover has decreased from more than 50% in the mid-80s to less than 30% as of last month. Glaciers are shrinking at record rates, and many could disappear within decades, says the United Nations Environment Program. Scientists measuring 30 glaciers around the world found ice loss reached record levels in 2006, the most recent year. Most severe loss was in Norway at a glacier I can't pronounce, which shrank by 10.2 feet. On the average, glaciers around the world shrank by about half that level. Figures are part of what appears to be an accelerating trend with no apparent end in sight, says the director of the World Glacier Monitoring Service. As the ice sheets melt, they can release pent-up energy and trigger massive earthquakes, according to a new study. Earthquakes? Ah, no big deal, baby. Take it from me. Global warming may already be triggering such earthquakes and may cause more in the future as ice continues to melt worldwide, the researchers say. A series of large earthquakes shook Scandinavia 10,000 years ago along faults that are now quiet, the scientists point out. The timing of each earthquake roughly coincided with the melting of thick ice sheets from the last ice age in those same places. Researchers had suspected the melting had triggered these quakes by releasing pressure that had built up in the Earth's crust. Now a new study, the first to use sophisticated computer models to simulate how ice sheets would affect the crust in the region, bolsters this scenario. The study showed earthquakes are suppressed in presence of the ice and promoted during the melting. But that's not all. The irrigation water vital for the grain crops that feed China and India is at risk of drying up as the glaciers melt. The world has never faced such a predictably massive threat to food production as that posed by the melting mountain glaciers of Asia, says Lester Brown of the Earth Policy Institute. The Ganges, Yellow, and Yangtze rivers in India and China are fed by rains during the monsoon season, but during the dry season they depend heavily on meltwater from Himalayan glaciers. The Gangotri Glacier in the Himalayas alone supplies 70% of the Ganges' dry season flow. That's precisely when water is needed most to irrigate the rice and wheat crops on which hundreds of millions of people depend. But the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reported last year that many Himalayan glaciers could disappear by 2035. Chinese glaciologists now estimate that two-thirds of the glaciers on the Tibet-Qinghai Plateau could be gone by 2060. But people are doing something to help. Japanese professional baseball players have vowed to shorten playing time per game as part of the national pastime's contribution to the fight against global warming. They will aim to cut playing time by 6% or 12 minutes from the average of 3 hours and 18 minutes per game. When a professional baseball game is staged, a huge amount of carbon dioxide is discharged because it requires use of energy to move players and spectators, supply electricity for lighting and other purposes, and dispose of food and drink waste, says the commissioner's office in Japan. The pledge to cut playing time would help Japan meet its obligations under the Kyoto Treaty, Japan, of course, being the home of the Kyoto Treaty. By reducing playing time by 12 minutes per game, the league or the national, it's the Nippon Professional Baseball, The NPB estimates this year baseball will cut its carbon dioxide emissions by 209 tons. To speed up games and save time, teams will be required to change offensive and defensive sides within 2 minutes and 15 seconds. The pitcher can spend no longer than 15 seconds throwing a pitch after receiving the ball from the catcher when all bases are empty. The measures would also be a boost for the sport, says the Japanese league, which faces growing competition from faster, more physical sports such as chess. And finally, the Washington cherry blossoms are going to burst out about the end of this month. 30 years ago, the trees usually waited to bloom until around April 5th. In Central California, the first of the field skipper Sachem, a drab little butterfly, was fluttering on March 12th. Just 25 years ago, the creature emerged from mid-April to mid-May. What's happening? This is part of a report that says biologists are worrying that the alarm clock that all plants and animals are listening to is running too fast. This according to a Stanford University biologist, Terry Root. The fingerprints of man-made climate change are evident in seasonal timing changes for thousands of species on Earth, according to dozens of studies and last year's authoritative report by the international climate scientists. More than 30 scientists told the Associated Press how global warming is affecting plants and animals at springtime across the country in nearly every state. What's happening is so noticeable, scientists can track it from space. Satellites measuring when land turns green found that spring green-up is arriving 8 hours earlier every year on average. News from the warm, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
When I was young, I lived in a world of dreams, of moods and myths and illusionary schemes. Though now I'm much more grown up, I fear that I must own up to the fact that I'm in doubt of what the modern cynics shout of. They say it's spring, this feeling light as a feather. They say this thing, this magic we share together, came with the weather too. They say it's May, that's made me daft as a daisy. It's May, they say. It's May, the whole world this crazy, heavenly hazy hue. I'm a lark on a wing, I'm the spark of a firefly's fling. Yet to me, this must be something more than a seasonal thing. Could it be spring? Those bells that I can hear ringing, it may be spring. But when robin stops singing, you're what I'm clinging to. Though they say it's spring, it's you. If poets sing, heart's sympathetic, maybe spring. Then poets' plights are pathetic, but I'm poetic too. They say it's spring, for lovers, there's where the September the cure is. This they are sure is true, though I know that it's so, that my fancy may turn in the spring with the right one inside. One can find a perpetual thing. Did I need spring to bring the ring that you bought me? Though it was spring, the wondrous day that you caught me. Darling, I thought we knew that it was in spring. It was you.
Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes this edition of Le Show. The program returns to you next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe, the USEN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world to the facilities of the American Forces Network up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet, around the world via your computer at two different locations, live and archived, kcrw.com and harryshearer.com, via the internet. You've heard of that. And the Mighty 104 in Berlin on Sirius and XM satellite radio as a free download at www.audible.com/LeShow and as a free podcast at kcrw.com. And it'll be just like spring arriving on time if you'd agree to be with me then, would you? All righty, thank you very much. You'll find the email of this broadcast as well as the playlist of the music featured here on at harryshearer.com. Always something interesting at harryshearer.com. That's a promise I just can't keep. Here's some street talk for you, ladies and my friends. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the Chicago, Pittsburgh, and San Diego desks, as well as Jenny Lawson here at WWNO-FM New Orleans. Jenny, who I believe helps the Hornets win, for helping me get through this today. And for helping me to end it on time, unlike last week. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless. So long from New Orleans.